They warned me on my first day, the way people warn you about a loose step on a staircase. Not dramatically, not kindly. Just enough to make you look down every time you pass that spot. They told me her name like it was a weather report. She's charming, she's helpful, she remembers everything. They said she collects secrets like trophies. And I remember thinking that sounded childish, like gossip with a pretty metaphor, like something bored people say when they don't want to admit they're intimidated. I didn't believe any of it until she smiled at me in the break room, warm as a lamp, and repeated something I'd never said out loud. Not something I'd posted, not something I'd texted, not something I'd hinted at, something I'd only thought. The smile didn't change when my face did. It stayed soft, familiar, like we were friends sharing a joke. After that, I watched every word leave my mouth like it was carrying my name on it. It was a Stockholm office that wanted to feel like a startup without paying like one. Glass walls, pale wood, plants in white pots, espresso machine that hissed like it was doing you a favor. The company was mid-size, tech-adjacent, the kind of place that made software for other people's problems and talked about culture like it was a product. I was hired into operations, which meant I was everyone's quiet solution. Scheduling, vendor coordination, travel, onboarding, the glue work, the work you only notice when it fails. I liked it like that. I liked being useful without being watched. I'd spent enough years in workplaces to know that attention is rarely free. It always costs something. It costs your privacy, your choices, your ability to make a mistake without having it become a story. My team sat near the middle of the floor, close enough to hear the sales team's laughter and far enough from the developer's headphones to not feel like you were intruding. The atmosphere had a constant low hum, phones buzzing, Slack pings, someone always microwaving something with too much garlic. The woman everyone warned me about didn't sit with us. She sat closer to leadership, near the cluster of offices with doors that were always half open. She wasn't an executive. She wasn't HR. She wasn't technically anyone's manager. Her title was something vague and impressive, People Experience Coordinator. If you asked what that meant, people would shrug and say she handled internal stuff. Events, communications, employee satisfaction surveys that nobody read, conflicts sometimes when they didn't want HR involved. She floated through the company like a well-dressed shadow. The first warning came from a man in finance while he helped me access the procurement system. "You'll meet Ellen soon," he said, casual. "Just be careful what you tell her." He said it like he was advising me not to drink the tap water. I laughed. I didn't even know her yet. I asked if she was difficult. "No," he said, "that's not the problem." Then he logged out of the system, closed his laptop, and left the sentence hanging like a coat you weren't sure was yours. The second warning came from a woman in customer success when she walked me to the kitchen and pointed out where they kept the oat milk. "Ellen will be really nice to you," she said. "She'll make you feel like you've known her forever." "Okay," I said, smiling, still trying to learn everyone's names. "And she'll ask you questions you don't realize are questions," the woman added. "Like, she's just making conversation, like she's curious, like she cares." I nodded polite, but inside I felt that familiar irritation. People love to dramatize coworkers. They love to make villains out of women who are just ambitious. I've seen it everywhere. A man is strategic. A woman is manipulative. A man is direct. A woman is difficult. So I filed the warnings away and kept going. The first time I met Elon was during a welcome lunch, one of those forced bonding meals that always feel like a test you haven't studied for. They'd booked a long table at a trendy place near the office with small plates and too much natural wine. Everyone smiled too hard, trying to seem friendly without looking desperate. She arrived late, which somehow made her seem important without her having to say it. She wore a cream blouse and a dark skirt, hair pulled back in a way that looked effortless but wasn't. She had the kind of face that made people lean in, not because it was perfect, but because it held attention. Bright eyes, a mouth that looked like it knew more than it said. She greeted people by name. She kissed cheeks lightly, Swedish style, but with a softness that felt intimate. When she reached me, she didn't do the quick new person handshake. She touched my forearm. "You must be Liv," she said. "My name isn't Liv." It was close, but not correct. I opened my mouth to correct her, and she laughed lightly, not unkind, and said, "Sorry, I'm terrible with names sometimes. Emelin, I've heard you're going to save us." It was ridiculous, but it felt good. It felt like being wanted. I said my actual name. She repeated it perfectly, like she'd never been wrong. Then she asked where I lived, how long I'd been in Stockholm, whether I'd moved for work or for love. Normal questions, harmless, that's what I told myself. But she asked them in a way that made you answer more than you meant to. She didn't ask, "Are you single?" She said, "Stockholm can be so lonely when you're new, especially if you don't have someone waiting at home." She didn't ask, "Do you have family here?" She said, "Do you have people nearby who feel like home, or is it mostly just you?" The table conversation flowed around us, but she kept pulling mine back to her, like a tide. People laughed at her jokes. They watched her face when she spoke, not because she was loud, because she made you feel chosen. I told her little things, where I'd lived before, that I'd worked in Copenhagen briefly, that I liked my coffee too strong, that I hated open-plan offices but pretended I didn't. She laughed in the right places, nodded like she understood me, and I felt myself relaxing. That's the trick with people like that. They don't push, they don't demand, they just create a space where you volunteer things and then you think it was your idea. After lunch, she walked with me back to the office. Her pace matched mine exactly, like she'd practiced. "You'll be great here," she said. "But there's one thing I tell every new woman." I waited. "Don't assume people are kind because they smile," she said. "Assume they're hungry." It was such a line. The kind of thing you'd see under a black and white photo on Instagram. But when she said it, she didn't sound dramatic. She sounded matter-of-fact, like she was giving me a survival tip. I remember thinking, maybe she wasn't the problem. Maybe the people warning me were the problem. On the second week, she invited me for coffee. Not a big deal. People did that. But the invite came in a private Slack message that felt like a velvet rope. "Coffee later? I want to hear how you're finding us." We sat in a corner of the kitchen area with our mugs and the city light coming through the windows, pale and sharp. She asked about my workload, about whether my manager was supportive, about whether I felt seen. Seen, that word. I told her my manager was fine, busy but fine. I told her I was still learning the systems, still getting used to the pace. She leaned closer. "And how are you sleeping?" she asked. It startled me. Not because it was offensive, because it was intimate. "Fine," I said automatically. Then, because her eyes were so steady, I added, "A bit restless. New place, new job, you know." I watched her absorb that like it was useful. She nodded slowly. "Stockholm does that to people," she said. "It's beautiful and it's cold and it makes you think too much." I laughed. I said, "Yeah, exactly." And then I said something I didn't mean to say. Something small but real. That sometimes, when I was alone at night, I thought about quitting before anyone realized I wasn't as capable as they thought. I didn't frame it as a confession. I said it like a joke, like we all felt that way. She didn't laugh. She said, "That's not funny. That's the most honest thing anyone has said to me this week." And then she smiled again, soft and familiar, and I felt my chest loosen. I felt understood. I felt safe. That was my first mistake. Believing that being understood by someone automatically meant they were on my side. By the third week, I noticed that Ellen somehow knew everything. Not in a vague workplace way, in a precise way. She knew which developer was interviewing elsewhere before he'd told his team. She knew which couple in marketing was quietly breaking up. She knew that the CEO's assistant was looking at apartments in another city. She knew which manager had been spoken to about his tone. People told her things. They must have. That was the only explanation. But the way she knew it, the way it slid out of her in conversation, made it feel like she wasn't collecting information. She was harvesting it. One afternoon, I was at my desk trying to fix a vendor contract that had the wrong payment terms. My manager was in meetings all day, and the vendor kept emailing like I was personally holding their money hostage. Elin appeared next to my desk without sound. She didn't scare me. She never did that. She was too smooth. "Hard day?" she asked. I exhaled, "Yeah, vendor stuff." She glanced at my screen just long enough to register the name of the vendor. Then she looked at me, sympathetic. "They're difficult," she said. "They always act like you're the problem." I smiled. She leaned on the edge of my desk lightly, like she belonged there. You know, she said, "You don't have to carry everything alone here." It was a generous sentence. It sounded like care. I said, "I'm fine." She nodded. "Of course you are. You're competent. That's why they'll keep adding things to your plate until you break." Then she straightened, as if she'd said something casual, and walked away. I sat there after she left, the sentence sticking to me. That's what she did. She planted little thoughts. Not accusations, not obvious ones, just seeds. And seeds grow when you're tired. At the end of my first month, there was a company social. Drinks at the office, fairy lights, music low enough to talk over. Someone had brought in a ridiculous amount of shrimp toast and chocolate truffles. I didn't love these events. I went anyway. It's part of the performance. You show your face, you smile, you prove you're a team player. Ellen moved through the room like she was hosting, even though it wasn't her event. She touched shoulders, laughed at jokes, tilted her head when people spoke, like she was listening with her whole body. She found me near the window with a glass of wine I didn't really want. "There you are," she said, like she'd been looking. I smiled, "I'm here." She leaned beside me, looking out at the dark city. Then she said softly, without looking at me, "You're holding yourself very tightly." I laughed awkwardly, "Am I?" "Yes," she said, "like you're afraid of being seen." It hit too close. It made my skin warm. I shrugged. "I'm just new." She nodded, still not looking. "Being new is dangerous. People project things onto you. They decide what you are before you speak." She finally turned her face toward me. "Have you noticed how Jonas watches you?" Jonas was a manager in another department, older than me, married, known for being charming in a way that felt practiced. I blinked. She smiled faintly. "Never mind. I shouldn't have said anything." But she had, and now it existed. I said, "I haven't noticed." She lifted her eyebrows like she didn't believe me, and then she looked away again. "Be careful," she said. "Women who are competent and quiet make men like Jonas curious, and curious men aren't always polite." My stomach tightened. I didn't know if it was fear or anger. I wanted to ask if she was warning me or testing me. Instead, I said, "Thanks." She smiled again, and then she walked off into the room, leaving me with my own imagination. That was the pattern. She didn't give you information. She gave you a question mark and let you fill it with whatever scared you most. The first time she repeated something I'd never said out loud happened on a Tuesday in the break room around mid-morning. I remember because I'd been counting days until my probation review. The office had that quiet tension of people pretending not to be stressed. I was making coffee, half awake, staring at the machine. Elin walked in behind me. She didn't announce herself. She just appeared in my peripheral vision like she'd always been there. She watched me for a second, then said, "You know, you don't have to prove you deserve the job." I smiled politely. I didn't respond right away. She leaned against the counter and said, "You keep thinking they're going to figure out you're not as capable as they think you are. Form video choice." My hand froze on the mug. That sentence was mine. Not something I'd said to anyone. Not even to Elin. Not like that. It was something I'd thought at night, alone, staring at my ceiling. Something I'd carried in my body like a bruise. I turned to look at her, slow. "What did you say?" I asked. She smiled, warm as a lamp. "Just that," she said. "You don't have to prove anything." My throat tightened. My heart thumped in a way that made my ears ring. "How did you?" "I started." She tilted her head, gentle. "I recognize patterns," she said. "I know that look." And maybe that was true. Maybe she'd guessed. Maybe I was that readable. But the way she said it, the timing, the exact words, made it feel like she'd been inside my skull. I laughed once, brittle. I said, "I don't know what you mean." She smiled wider, like she'd won something. "Of course you do," she said softly. Then she walked out, leaving the smell of her perfume and the feeling of being exposed. After that, I watched every word leave my mouth. The week after the break room moment, my behavior changed in ways I didn't fully recognize until later. It wasn't dramatic. I still did my job. I still answered emails. I still smiled when people passed my desk. But I started editing myself in real time. I stopped saying little personal things. I stopped mentioning what I did on weekends. I stopped complaining about being tired. I stopped joking about my nerves. I started keeping my thoughts behind my teeth. And that kind of self-monitoring is exhausting. It turns your whole day into a performance, not just your work. I also started watching Elin. not in an obvious way, not with suspicion on my face, but I noticed things. I noticed how she lingered near conversations that weren't meant for her, how she'd pour coffee slowly when two people were talking nearby, like she was just making a drink, like she wasn't listening. I noticed how she always positioned herself in doorways, half in, half out, so she could be included without being invited. I noticed how people's bodies shifted when she approached, how some people became more animated, eager to impress her, and others became smaller, quieter, as if trying to disappear. I noticed how she used warmth like a tool. On Monday, she'd compliment someone's work publicly in Slack, and by Wednesday, she'd bring up their mistake casually in a meeting, framed as concern. On one day, she'd be your confidant. The next, she'd be the person who just happened to know what you'd been worried about. It wasn't enough to accuse her of anything. There was no single moment you could point to and say, that's the crime. That's what made it powerful. It was all plausible, all soft, all deniable. One afternoon, I was called into a meeting with my manager and HR to discuss a minor process issue. It wasn't serious. A vendor invoice had been delayed because of a mismatch in our system. It was the kind of thing that happens in any company, the kind of thing you fix and move on. But when I sat in the meeting room, my manager looked tense, and the HR woman looked like she'd already decided what the story was. They talked about accuracy, about attention to detail, about impact. I apologized. I explained what had happened. I offered a solution. My manager nodded, but HR kept her eyes on me. And then she said, we've also heard that you've been struggling with confidence. The sentence made the room feel smaller. I looked at her. I said, I'm sorry. She smiled in a way that wasn't friendly, more like practiced concern. We just want to make sure you feel supported, she said. Sometimes new hires feel overwhelmed. Sometimes they doubt themselves. It's normal. My face went hot. I hadn't told HR anything about my confidence. I hadn't told my manager. I hadn't told anyone except Elin, that coffee conversation in week two. The joke I made. The thing I said like it was nothing. My chest tightened with anger so sharp it almost felt clean. I forced myself to smile. I said, I'm fine. I'm adjusting like anyone would. I'm committed to the role. HR nodded slowly like she was filing it away. After the meeting, my manager walked me back to my desk. Don't take it personally, she said. HR likes to cover bases. I wanted to ask how HR had gotten that information. I wanted to ask if my manager had said something, if she'd noticed something, if I'd been obvious, but I already knew. I sat at my desk and felt something shift inside me. Not fear, not exactly. Something colder. I opened Slack and stared at Ellen's name in my sidebar. I didn't message her. Not yet. Instead, I started playing a game I hated. I started being careful about what I told anyone, not just her. Because once you realize information can be used against you, you stop trusting the whole room. That's how workplaces rot. Not from one scandal, but from the slow erosion of safety. Ellen found me later that day, like she had a sense for when I was thinking about her. She stopped by my desk with a bright smile. How are you doing? She asked. That meeting earlier sounded intense. My stomach dropped. She shouldn't have known about the meeting. It wasn't public. I kept my face neutral. It was fine, I said. Just process stuff. She tilted her head, sympathetic. I'm glad they're supporting you. Supporting me. The word made my jaw clench. I looked at her and tried to see her clearly, to see whether she was cruel or simply hungry for control, to see whether she enjoyed it or whether it was just how she survived. She said softly, people here like to find weak spots. Don't give them any. It was almost comical. She was the one extracting them. I smiled politely and said, thanks for the advice. She returned the smile and walked away. That night, I lay in bed in my apartment, the winter darkness pressed against the windows, and I realized I was thinking about her the way you think about a threat. Not a big one. Not a dramatic one. A subtle one that changes how you move. I started to understand why people had warned me. They weren't being childish. They were being practical. The next escalation came through Jonas. It started small. A compliment on a presentation I'd helped coordinate, a casual comment in the kitchen about how organized I was, then a message on Slack asking if I could help him with a travel request. It was within my scope. I did it. Then he started stopping by my desk more often, leaning in slightly too close, smiling like we had a shared secret. I wasn't imagining it. the tone was different from how he spoke to men, softer, more personal. One afternoon, he said, "We should grab a drink sometime outside this place." I smiled and said, "I'm pretty busy." He laughed, like I was flirting. That same day, Elin appeared at my desk after Jonas left. "You handled that well," she said. My throat tightened. I said, "What?" She smiled, "Not innocent, Jonas. He's persistent." I stared at her. "How did you know what he said?" She shrugged lightly. "People talk." That was her favorite shield. "People talk." I felt something snap, small but real. I said, "Elin, did you tell HR I was struggling with confidence?" Her expression didn't change. Not immediately. Then she gave me a look, like I'd disappointed her. "Why would you think that?" she asked. I held her gaze. "Because HR brought it up in a meeting," I said. "And the only person I've said anything like that to is you." She blinked slowly. Then she smiled, gentle again. "Oh, sweetheart," she said softly. "I would never betray you like that." The word sweetheart landed wrong. Too intimate, too patronizing. She leaned in slightly. "But I do talk to HR sometimes," she admitted. "It's part of my role. They come to me about culture issues, about well-being, about patterns." I felt my hands go cold. "So you did tell them?" She shook her head, still smiling. "I didn't tell them you said it. I told them I was concerned about you, that you seemed tense, that you might need support. That's what friends do." Friends, I wanted to laugh. I wanted to scream. Instead, I said, "I don't need you to be concerned about me." Her smile sharpened, just slightly. "Okay," she said, "if that's what you want." Then she stepped back, and her warmth receded like a curtain being pulled. In that moment, I understood something I'd learned before, but forgotten. There are people who interpret boundaries as insults, and when you insult them, they don't rage. They adjust. They recalibrate. They make you pay quietly. The next week, small things started happening. A calendar invite disappeared from my schedule. An onboarding document I'd created was edited without my knowledge, and my name was removed. A vendor contact I'd been working with suddenly stopped responding, and when I followed up, they said they'd been told someone else was handling it now. None of it was dramatic. None of it was traceable. But it was like my hands were being gently pried off my own work. In meetings, people would reference decisions I hadn't been included in. My manager started asking me if I was okay more often with that HR tone. The worst part was how it made me look unreliable. Like I wasn't on top of things. Like I was slipping. And then one afternoon, I walked past the leadership offices and heard my name. Not loudly, not as gossip, as a subject. Ellen's voice, low and smooth, inside one of the half-open doors. "She's capable," she was saying, "but she's sensitive. She takes things personally." I froze in the hallway, my heart thudding. Another voice, a man's voice, said something I couldn't catch. Elin replied, "I'm just saying, keep an eye. She wants to do well, but she's fragile." Fragile. I felt something hot rise up my neck. I kept walking. I didn't burst in. I didn't confront her, because I'd learned by then that direct confrontation was exactly what she could survive. She could smile through it. She could deny. She could frame it as my instability. So I did what people do in workplaces when they realize the system has teeth. I adapted. I started documenting everything, not in a dramatic whistleblower way, in a quiet survival way. I saved emails. I took screenshots. I noted dates. I kept a private log on my personal laptop at home, not on company devices. I learned to treat my own memory like evidence. I also started playing her game, which is the part I'm not proud of. I started feeding her harmless information, small, bland details, things that wouldn't hurt me if they spread, things that would make her think she still had access. When she asked how I was sleeping, I said fine. When she asked if I was dating, I said I was too busy. When she asked about Jonas, I said I hadn't noticed anything. And I watched her face each time, looking for disappointment, looking for the moment she realized she was no longer getting trophies. Sometimes she looked bored. Sometimes she looked amused. It made me sick that I was thinking about her that way, that I was strategizing around another woman like she was a predator. But that's what happens when someone turns human connection into a weapon. The climax came at the holiday planning meeting. It was supposed to be simple. Budget, venue, food preferences. Elin was leading it, of course, because it was culture. I was there because operations had to manage logistics. My manager was there, half distracted. HR was there. A few team leads. Ellen sat at the head of the table like she belonged there. She smiled at everyone, then looked at me and said, "And of course, we want to make sure we don't overwhelm anyone." Some of us have been feeling a bit insecure lately. Her eyes stayed on me as she said it, just long enough. Not a direct accusation. Not a statement with my name on it, but everyone felt the aim. A few people shifted in their seats. My manager glanced at me, concerned. My face stayed still, but inside I went cold. Ellen continued talking about budgets and decorations, like she hadn't just cut me open in front of the room. In that moment, I understood why people stay quiet, why they swallow things. Because when someone is subtle, if you react, you look dramatic. If you don't react, you disappear. I waited until after the meeting, when the hallway was mostly empty, and Ellen was walking back toward her desk. I followed her, my footsteps controlled, my voice calm. "Ellen," I said. She turned, smile ready. "Yes?" I said, "Stop using my private conversations as material." Her smile didn't falter. She blinked slowly, as if considering how to respond. "I don't know what you mean," she said. I held her gaze. "You do." She sighed softly, like I was tiring her. "Listen," she said, "you're new. You're still learning how things work here. I'm trying to help you. But if you want to isolate yourself, that's your choice." Then she stepped closer, her voice lowering. "But don't make me your enemy," she said. "You won't like it." She said it calmly, almost kindly. That's what made it terrifying. Then she smiled again and walked away. After the hallway moment, the office felt different, as if the air had been adjusted by someone with access to the controls. Nothing exploded, nobody yelled, there was no HR showdown, no dramatic firing, no public humiliation. It was quieter than that. It was the slow, systematic tightening of a net. My manager started including HR in more of our one-on-ones just to support you. HR started asking me how I was coping with pressure. People started offering help I hadn't asked for, with that careful kindness that suggests they've been told you're unstable. It was brilliant, in a sick way. If I protested, I looked defensive. If I accepted, I confirmed the story. Ellen didn't have to attack me directly. She let the narrative do the work. That's what secrets are in workplaces. They're not just information, they're leverage. And Ellen knew how to turn a whisper into a shape people could see. I tried to fight it with competence. I became even more precise. I double-checked everything. I responded to emails faster. I stayed late. I volunteered for tasks no one wanted. It didn't help, because when someone has decided you're fragile, your competence becomes proof you're overcompensating. I watched it happen in real time. A successful project became, "She's trying too hard." A missed detail became, "See, she can't handle pressure." A quiet day became, "She's withdrawn." A friendly laugh became, "She's masking." There was no winning inside a story that wasn't mine. The first real consequence came when my probation review date arrived. I walked into the meeting room with my notes, my list of projects, my calm face. My manager and HR were already there. Ellen wasn't in the room, but I felt her presence anyway, like perfume that lingers after someone leaves. The meeting started with polite positives, organized, helpful, quick learner. Then HR leaned forward and said, "We've had some concerns about your integration." Integration. That word is always a trap. It can mean anything. They talked about fit, about communication, about emotional resilience. I listened, nodding, while something inside me hardened. At one point, my manager said, "Some people have mentioned you seem guarded." I wanted to laugh. Guarded, yes, because I learned that sharing here was dangerous. I asked calmly, "Who has mentioned that?" My manager hesitated. HR smiled politely. "We don't want to make it personal," HR said. "It's just general feedback." General feedback is how cowards hide. I took a breath and said, "I'd like specifics. I'd like examples tied to my work." HR's smile tightened. "This isn't about a single incident," she said. "It's about patterns." Patterns, that was Elon's word. I looked at my manager. I said, "Have you had any issues with my work output or accuracy?" My manager paused, then said, "No. Your work is strong. So what are we doing here?" I asked, still calm. There was a silence. The kind that tells you they didn't expect you to push back. HR said, "We're just ensuring you have support." Support again, that soft weapon. I left the meeting with my job intact, but the message was clear. They weren't firing me. They were conditioning me, teaching me to accept being monitored, teaching me that my inner life belonged to the office. After that, I stopped trying to be liked. I focused on being untouchable. I tightened my boundaries so hard they almost cut me. I stopped attending optional social events. I stopped making small talk. I stopped smiling when I didn't feel like it. It made people uncomfortable, which in a twisted way made me feel powerful again. But it also made me lonely, and loneliness is another kind of control. Ellen didn't approach me much after that. She didn't need to. Her story had already moved through the building. When she did speak to me, it was always in public, always pleasant, always just enough to look innocent. "How are you?" she'd say brightly in the kitchen, loud enough for others to hear. "Fine," I'd say, "neutral." "Good," she'd reply, smiling. "I'm glad. We were all worried. Worried, always worried." As if I were a glass object, as if she hadn't been the one tapping the cracks. The final shift happened when Jonas was promoted. It was announced in a company-wide meeting. Applause, smiles, the usual performance. Elin clapped enthusiastically, eyes bright. Jonas gave a humble speech about teamwork. After the meeting, Jonas stopped by my desk, grinning. "Now you'll have to listen to me even more," he said, playful. I smiled politely, nothing in my eyes. He leaned closer. "We should celebrate," he said. I said, "Congratulations, Jonas. I have work to finish." He looked at me for a moment, then walked away, irritation flickering behind his smile. A few minutes later, Ellen appeared at my desk. She stood there, hands folded, expression soft. "You know," she said, "people notice when you don't play along." My stomach tightened. I looked up at her. "What do you mean?" She smiled faintly. "I mean, you're making choices, and choices have consequences." It was so calm, so reasonable. I said, "Are you threatening me?" Her smile widened just slightly. "No," she said, "I'm advising you, like I always have." I stared at her and realized something. Ellen didn't need secrets anymore. She'd already collected enough. Now she was collecting compliance. She walked away, and I sat there for a long time, staring at my inbox, feeling my own pulse. That night, I opened my private log at home and read through it. Dates, screenshots, note patterns. I could take it to HR, but HR was already part of it. I could take it to my manager, but my manager had already been infected by the narrative. I could escalate higher, but higher was where Ellen lived, close to the offices with half-open doors. So I did what people do when they realize the system protects itself. I made a plan to leave. Quietly, I started applying for other jobs. I updated my CV at night. I reached out to old contacts. I interviewed during lunch breaks, lying about dentist appointments. It wasn't dramatic. It was survival. When I got an offer, I accepted it within an hour. I didn't tell anyone until my resignation letter was ready. On the day I submitted it, my manager looked shocked. She asked why. She asked if we could talk. She asked if there was something we could fix. I wanted to tell her everything. I wanted to throw the whole story on the table and watch it shatter. But I didn't. I said I found an opportunity that fits me better. Because in that moment, I understood something else. Even if I told the truth, it would become another story about me, about my sensitivity, about my inability to integrate. And Elin would survive it. She'd smile through it. She'd frame it. She'd harvest it. So I left without giving her anything new. On my last day, there was a small farewell fika, cinnamon buns, coffee, smiles. Ellen came, of course. She hugged me lightly, as if we were close, as if she hadn't spent months tightening a net around me. "You'll do well," she whispered near my ear. "You just need the right environment." I pulled back and looked at her. She smiled, warm as a lamp, and then she said softly, so only I could hear, "Don't worry, I'll take care of things here." It took me a second to understand what she meant. Not take care of my work, take care of my story. I smiled back, because I'd learned something by then. I said, "I'm sure you will." And I walked out of that office with my head high and my mouth closed, feeling the cold Stockholm air hit my face like a clean slap. Even now, years later, I still catch myself editing my words in new workplaces. I still feel that instinct to keep my inner life locked up. I still notice who asks too many questions, who leans in too close, who makes warmth feel like a transaction. People like Ellen don't disappear. They change offices, they change titles, they learn new language, but the pattern stays the same. They collect, they smile, and they make you pay for believing the smile was free.